Well, thunderstorms and other severe weather are common every spring in Wisconsin. But why? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. And who can answer that question better than the weather guys? Good thing they're back with us. John Martin is a professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and I'm sure he'll be here any minute. And Steve Ackerman is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. And Steve is also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. What weather questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, thanks for being here, and hopefully Steve is on his way. Or I'm the other way around. Hi, Steve. Hopefully John is on his way.
I am sure he is. He's teaching in a classroom, and so I'm sure he's running here now.
That's right. And we appreciate him doing that because it's like cross campus, right?
And it is, and he's a great teacher as well. So I'm sure the classroom's try and keep him there and talk more and more about the weather and what's going on.
Of course, kind of like Indiana Jones, I'll bet.
Sort of like that. That's right. Although he doesn't have that hat.
He doesn't have that hat. Maybe we need to talk to him about that.
About that, right. Yeah, get rid of that Boston baseball cap and put it
on a cool hat. Right. So anyway, weather. Okay. You know, it was really beautiful this weekend, and today I've got my winter coat back out. Why are we so up and down in the spring?
In the springtime, you know, march in like a lion, out like a lamb. Although on Friday it may have seemed like for southern Wisconsin, Madison hit a record high temperature at 77, I think it was.
Oh, maybe 78. Gosh. Wow.
But yeah, I mean, that whole saying, that folklore saying, one of the aspects of that is associated with the variability that we typically have in March. Although, if you live in northern Wisconsin with the ice storm that they had up there, I'm sure they are not thinking the end of March is acting like a lamb and being very passive.
Is that changing since we've had all these weather changes?
No, not really. In the sense that, you know, March and April, think about March, it's at the end of the winter, and so we're dealing with potential of winter storms at the beginning of the month. Which we can still get at the end of the month, and we can also get that in April. It's just likely.
I think that is in the forecast for the state, actually.
It's getting
tonight,
more snowfall.
Tomorrow.
Right, yeah. And that's what it is. I mean, we're entering, you know, the summertime type convection of springtime, late springtime.
And what causes that? Is that a jet stream thing?
So the jet stream, where the jet stream is located, tends to support where convection occurs. You want to have an unstable atmosphere as well. And you need to have the sun up to heat the surface as well. And so by the time we're getting into April, all of those things beginning to line up. Doesn't mean they can't line up in January. In fact, we did have thunderstorms this past January as well.
Yes,
so we can have weather, almost any kind of weather at almost any time, except maybe, I guess I wouldn't go with snowfall in summer, but
don't
probably
say it
a
too
little
loud.
Time, right?
You just never know these days. Well, it keeps us on our toes, right?
That's true.
Yes.
And that's what we want. Weather is very important to us, and our ability to predict it is also very important.
Very much so. So I just heard through Joel, our producer here, that every year spring is 30 seconds shorter than the year before. And then that means that every summer is 30 seconds longer, and that this has been happening for thousands of years. And nobody told me. Why does this happen?
And I think you wouldn't notice it unless you were an astronomer and look at that. And I think the issue that's going on here is a couple of things. One is the, you know, when we have our summer, our axis in the northern hemisphere is pointing towards the sun. But that wobbles around. It's not all that uniform. And the way that it's been wobbling is that it's now been occurring 30 seconds earlier, which means that we're taking some time away, if you will, from the springtime. The other thing that's going on is that the Earth is not in a circular orbit. It's in an elliptical orbit. And so when we're farther away from the sun, the Earth is moving slower. And so that occurs in our northern hemisphere summer. And so the axis is moving a little bit earlier, and the Earth is rotating a little bit slower. And that makes the summer 30 seconds longer, a little bit longer, which takes time away from spring. And apparently winter. I guess winter is getting shortage. But like you said, we're not going to notice it.
We're not going to notice it. We don't even have a winter here anymore.
Oh, he sounds so disappointed.
John's a snowstorm kind of guy.
So when you retire, you're moving to Antarctica? Or
no, I don't have any control over that, Joel. I'll probably be staying exactly right here and watching the winters disappear even more. I hope I'm wrong.
So you're going to be that complaining old guy on the porch.
I already am. Yeah. I passed that a long time ago.
So now you're talking about that wiggle thing. Now, is that the opposite then for the southern hemisphere?
Right? Yes, yeah. It would. So it would make their winter times 30 seconds longer.
All right. There you can move to Australia.
Yeah. So they don't really have
winter.
They don't have winter down there.
That's true.
There's not enough land where it's wintry down there.
too much ocean.
Yeah.
We'll find a spot for you. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about rain gauges. Okay. So, I know what they are. How do they actually work? Because I'm thinking, well, if the rain is coming in on the side, how do they fill up on top? Go ahead, John.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there is, you figure out what the aerial cross-section is of the opening, and then you can adjust the collection device that way. So, if you've got a circle that's, one centimeter in radius, you can figure out the area over which the rain's falling and how much volume it should take if you get a certain depth.
Okay.
But the problems with the direction of the rainfall and high winds and all, it's not a small problem. And I think there are some ways in which that can be slightly corrected for, but if I'm not wrong, there's not a systematic solution to that.
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. And I think it becomes a real problem as well in measuring snowfall, where they used to have those big basins to collect it instead of having a small rain gauge that maybe it's, 6 inches in diameter. Mm. The snowfall ones are much, much bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the best way to do snow, what I've heard anyway, is that you're supposed to take several different measurements in a, 100-foot square area and then take the average of that after it's all done.
Yeah.
But when you're measuring snow as it falls, like they have to with the Weather Service, they use a snowboard, and they just measure how much fell in the last hour and without compaction, without anything. So the numbers can sometimes be exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
But it is pretty consistent. So I'm part of this national rain gauge network. It's called Kokoros Community something Rain Hail.
I know this. Community Collaborative Rain Hail and Snow Network.
Whoa. Right. That's what it is.
Aren't you impressed?
I am. That is. I gotta say, that's not even out of your back pocket. You were ready with that.
Well, awesome. Thank you to Joel for writing the script. So it was right there.
If you're going to participate that, you have to get a certain rain gauge and put it in a certain spot, and they give you all those directions. But whenever it rains, I go and look at what was my measurement in comparison to the people in the area. And it's generally within a tenth of an inch of liquid precipitable water or less.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So it works out pretty well. Yeah. Although, I guess when I'm looking at people who are nearby, they're probably having the same wind conditions.
Yeah, undoubtedly, especially where you live. Yeah, yeah. Must be a problem.
So placement is really important, I would think.
Mm. Yeah, you got to be in open air, open sky. You don't want to be having trees block it and things like that.
Just like 10 feet away. It really needs to be fine.
It needs
to
be pretty open.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So those of you who have your rain gauges out there, that's what you need to know. And again, it was Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, Kokoros.
Yeah.
I like that. Mm. It's like you're in favor of chocolate.
Right? Yeah. I think that's why I like it. It's that cocoa part.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And so if someone is collecting that, how can they submit it?
So if you look up Kokoros, RHS. There'll be a website there, and they'll tell you how to order it and how to join the group.
Oh, okay. All right.
And there's a bunch during the state, and it's actually very useful, not just for weather and weather geeks like us who like to look at how much it's raining, but we're an agricultural state, and so with a lot of observations, if we could have a lot of observations in northern Wisconsin, then we can really monitor what is the precipitation and how are we doing with regard to water conditions throughout the state, at least through the precipitation part of that.
And the water conditions, are we still pretty darn low?
I think we're still in a dry situation. Yeah. We're not in a drought yet.
Right. It's not as desperate as it was, probably in the earlier part of the wintertime.
Yeah.
But it's still drier than normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I've noticed that when it's raining, it's soaking in. It's not staying on top.
Yeah, yesterday was a great example of that. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. John in Port Wing emailed to say that when he was younger, he had a local weather reporter on TV that always talked about the Hadley cells. As he recalls, they had to do with the location and track of low pressure centers.
No, not really. The Hadley cell is a global circulation cell that's kind of anchored out around the equator. It's a little north of the equator in our summer, maybe a little south of it in our winter. And it's a broad-scale circulation that responds to the intense solar radiation in the equatorial regions, sets up a sort of a thunderstorm belt that's called the intertropical convergence zone. And then it has circulations that extend almost to 30 degrees poleward on either side, more likely about 20 degrees. And so that's in the equatorial regions. That's in the tropics. So it doesn't have too much to do with regions of low pressure and high pressure here in the mid latitudes. They're quite separate.
So those effects just don't go that far?
Except in extreme cases. Okay. You can have influence of, you know, some excursion of tropical air from something that may have originated near the Hadley latitudes into the extratropics, but it's not common.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thanks for that email, John. We're joined today by John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of the same department. Give us a call. Lines are open for some reason, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Remember, if you miss part of our show or want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives, wpr.org/Larry. Go to the archives and you can hear recordings of our broadcasts, and they go back a long way. We have some callers, so let's go to Ethan in Madison. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so recently in Madison, we've had a lot of rainfall, and honestly, the rainfall's been quite dirty. So I'm just wondering, you know, where is this amount of dirt coming from? Because on windows and on cars, you'll see after the rainfall, there's just streaks of dirt. I'm just wondering how there's so much accumulation of dirt in the rain recently.
Yeah, it was, what was it, 2 weeks ago, I think now.
Yeah,
it
would have
been. We had two successive substantial dust events from the southwest states, I think New Mexico and western Texas, that got involved in the circulation of a then-evolving cyclone in both cases that gave us rain. And eventually, like a day and a half later, and at the heart of almost every raindrop that falls on your head, there's going to be something called a cloud condensation nuclei, because the water won't condense at normal temperatures and pressures, the ones we expect them to, unless they condense on a foreign object. So if you've got a dust storm in the vicinity of a developing cyclone, that provides a lot of foreign objects that end up being nuclei for some of those drops. So you're exactly right. We had a muddy rain in a couple of different events there in the middle part of this month. Exactly correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So now he's going to have to clean his rain gauge pretty well then, right?
That's right. Yeah. Got to keep it clean. That's the other requirement.
Thank you for that observation, Ethan. Carolyn in Madison, you go right ahead.
Hi. I noticed a couple of extra low pressure barometric readings over the past, well, maybe 6-8 months. And one of them was like 29.04, way down there, almost 28. And is that something usual or unusual?
Yeah, those are pretty low pressures. You're down in the 970-ish millibar range there. That's the unit that I'm a little bit more commonly used in my practice. But that's a pretty low pressure, but they happen occasionally. Where are you calling from exactly?
Madison.
Oh, in Madison. So we've had a couple of storms this during the wintertime, especially late in the winter, that brought us a lot of rain where the pressure was pretty low. I'm trying to remember the one that was exceptionally low that might be the one you're referring to, but 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think, sometime in the month of March. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if our pressures were down around 970 or so millibars. Maybe it was March 12th or 13th, something like that. So, yeah, they happen. They're not common, you're right, and not at our latitude, but they do happen. And when they do, they catch the attention of the vigilant observer like yourself. So that's exciting for me to hear that.
That's interesting because I don't typically look at what pressure is? I mean, I'm always looking at the pressure gradient because that's going to influence what the wind is or define what the wind is. So I'll have to start looking at what is the pressure, actually.
Sometimes we can get really low. I think the lowest all time that since I've lived here anyway, 31 years of living here, has been something in the high 960s. And so that's
pretty low.
Yeah, it's pretty low. That's going to be 28.7 or so inches of mercury. That's well below the one you're talking about, but in the same league of rarity. Yeah.
I thought you were going on. Sorry about that. Yeah. So for those that aren't really up on all this weather jargon, what does that mean when the pressure is low? What happens or what can we expect?
Yeah, that's a good question. The pressure is low because somehow the atmosphere has evacuated mass out of that column at the bottom of which the pressure is low and distributed it somewhere else. The only way to do that is to have really vigorous upward-directed vertical motions. That takes the air out like digging dirt out of a hole. And in the process of the air rising rapidly to do that, you produce enormous amounts of clouds and precipitation. So the two go hand in hand, even though the effects are simultaneous but not one leading to the other. And so when you have a really intense low-pressure system, you have got a really intense circulation and precipitation shield that has corresponded with that development. So I'll tell you the honest truth, the exact correspondence between the vertical motion and the way the pressure falls to the ground is still an unsolved problem, and I'm working on it. And people in my field, in my sub-discipline, will laugh when I say that, but I will challenge them to tell me what the answer is,
okay.
And they can't do it.
Well, we will wait until you get that figured
I hope so.
Out. Gary in the town of Ween, go right ahead.
Hi, great show as always. I love the weather, guys. My question is, with all the cutbacks being done into federal agencies, and especially the weather agencies, I saw a piece in the Green Bay paper the other day where they're only sending up one weather balloon a day, and forecasting has become so much better and saved so many lives and helped our agriculture, because then people know what's coming. How can people who are normally brain functioning support these policies?
Well,
there's a lot there, but let's
a lot
just
there, but
it's,
but
talk
you,
about
you ask a really good question, and that is that you're right. Weather forecasting has gotten really good. And that's coupled with the fact that our modeling, our understanding of the weather, and our observation system all feed into making good weather forecasts. And good weather forecasts are not only important to agriculture, as you point out, but to daily life and to protecting lives. I mean, we're entering the severe weather season right now, and which means a lot of potential thunderstorms and tornadoes. And in order to do that forecasting accurately, you need to have the initial conditions, which means the current observations. And once you start cutting back our observations that feed those models, and in some cases going back to what they were 40, 50 years ago, you're not going to improve weather forecasting. So you're not going to improve weather forecasting. You're not going to, well, maybe you'll save money because you'll be cutting funding down. But that the damage that that could cause in terms of poor forecasting, it just doesn't make any sense to anybody who knows anything about the weather.
No, it makes no sense. And it should make the average citizen angry.
Yes.
That in our country, we're a rich country and we're a responsible country. We're having a retrenchment of services provided by our government, provided by us to ourselves for no reason at all. And the chairwoman of the committee that oversees DOGE is from Northwest Georgia. And there may well be a disastrous weather event in Northwest Georgia today. I wonder how many people will be as rabid about cutting back on the weather service after today's transpires than they were when they woke up. And I'm going to guess the number will be substantially smaller. And they're also talking about getting rid of who comes in to clean up after a natural disaster, FEMA. We're going to just do away with it. The states can take care of it themselves. No, they can't. They cannot take care of it themselves. So we've got a perverted view right now in our national government. I'm desperately angry about it, and I hope other people are as well. And we can all go to the polls tomorrow and do something about it.
Okay, thank you. You know, weather forecasting is currently a public-private partnership. If private or commercial interests, took over the duties of NOAA, what would the consequences be of that?
They can't take
it
over.
Right.
They can't,
right.
They can't take it over.
It's too big of an operation.
Yeah, right. It's part of an international network of data sharing, data collection. Agreements have been signed between countries to make sure this goes on. Agreements have been signed between companies and governments to make sure this goes on. There is no private sector that can come in and do it. And there's not a single private sector company currently in operation that doesn't leech off of the National Weather Service products and products by NOAA. So they're not equipped to do it.
And I don't think there's a private industry that would want to do that.
That's correct.
Because it is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, to maintain the observations, for one, to maintain the computer infrastructure to do the forecast, you know, is two. And number three, as John says, that data, once NOAA and National Weather Service produce it, is freely available to everybody.
Yeah.
So why would you want to take that on?
Right. It's such an obvious case of a government-run entity, the National Weather Service, being responsible to the citizens of the country, and private enterprises are responsible to their shareholders. This is fundamentally opposed. And yet, over the last 50-plus years, there's been an ecosystem that's grown that has allowed a public-private partnership that really works in our country. Why do you go around taking it apart when it works?
Yeah.
It's senseless.
We're talking to the Weather Guys today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Bob emailed to say it seems that weather predictions are getting better, but recently have gotten worse. Bob says he's unable to count on tomorrow's forecast anymore. His theory is that climate change is introducing variables that are no longer able to be properly accounted for in the models that predict the weather, or the models simply aren't up to speed for humans' impact on the climate.
Well, it's sometimes difficult to parcel out perception from reality when it comes to these kinds of things. My guess is that I would have very strong statistical backing in making this statement that 1 and 2 day weather forecasts today are better than they've ever been in the past, without question. They're almost at about a 95% level of accuracy measured by a variety of different ways. That doesn't mean that you don't get an occasional day that is just dead wrong in the short term, in that 0 to 2 days. And that day is likely to have a longer footprint, a longer shadow in your memory than the 8 days out of the 10 that are right on target. So I wonder if some of the perception is clouded by that, you know, the fact that we all have biases about, hey, this didn't go right when I needed it to go right. Because there's nothing particularly influential about the slow period climate changes that are going on that influence the 1 to 2 day forecast in such a way as it'd be systematically getting worse. And there's nothing process-wise, kind of goes along with the prior statement, nothing process-wise about that set of circumstances that would affect the way the models perform in the short term either.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I would put it as physics is physics. And as long as we know what that change is in the climate, and I know that to some that's now become a word you're not allowed to say, but we will continue to say it, that climate change is occurring. But, you know, even if you think about it, even in an extreme sense, that Wisconsin's climate is no, it's maybe more now what it was in Indiana or something. Our forecasts in Indiana are still very accurate.
That's right. That's right.
That's so right. As long as we know what that base state is and we have the right models running, I think we're going to, as the climate changes, the forecasts will continue to get better because methodologies are getting better.
Exactly right.
Of course, if the database of observations goes down, then we won't get better.
Yeah, that's also right.
But that won't
be
due to climate. That'll be the political climate, not...
Right.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. I'm sorry. I thought we had a call. We didn't. Greg emailed, what area of the country is considered Tornado Alley, and are tornadoes overall increasing in frequency and or severity?
It's interesting. The Tornado Alley question is really interesting. Victor Gensini and some colleagues down in Northern Illinois University had a really interesting study. Maybe it's now 2 years ago.
Yeah,
sorry, Vic,
recent.
If I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of the frequency of tornadoes in the spring has moved eastward. So Tornado Alley used to be traditionally North Texas, North Central Texas, Red River Valley, and in through Central Oklahoma and Kansas, and it's moved a little bit further eastward. And I believe maybe there's also a delay, a slight offset the on the delay, calendar, yeah. But I could be wrong about that. Now, in terms of the frequency and intensity, I don't recall those details. I was more interested myself in the displacement of Tornado Alley. Maybe you know, Steve.
Yeah, no, I don't remember the intensity. I was looking at the same thing, the map of how it's shifting. And again, back to the previous caller, you know, part of that is associated with how the climate is changing in these regions. And so we're still being able to predict those tornadoes. It's just that they're shifting where they occur.
And we're just a week past the anniversary, 100th anniversary, actually, of the tri-state tornado disaster, Illinois, Missouri, and parts of maybe Indiana. 695 people died in that. It still is the greatest tornado casualty ever in the United States history. So that testifies to a couple of things when you think about it. We are much better at monitoring these things and giving people warning. Because the city of St. Louis, the city and surrounding cities in Illinois and further north in Illinois, were not bigger in 1925 than they are now. St. Louis may have been, but the rest of them are not bigger than they were in 1925. We just have a better warning system and a better prediction system. So it flies in the face of exactly the kind of things we were just talking about. We do better at saving people's lives today, demonstrably. The weather hasn't gotten less violent. We're just better at getting it pinpointed and getting people out of harm's way. And if we reduce those services, we're going to go back to the good bad days, which were 100 years ago when people died in the threat of tornadoes because they didn't know they were coming.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting phrase that I hadn't thought of before. Yeah. Weather isn't less violent.
Yeah, it's not. And it certainly doesn't care about you any more than it ever did. So,
is it more violent?
I suppose an argument could be made that it may be more violent. And that would be the part of this study that I wish I could recall. It might quite be the case.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Chris in Fairchild. Go ahead, Chris.
Good afternoon. See, I was wondering if you could speak to NOAA's impact as it pertains to national security and the way that that information is passed down through the Department of Defense. And also, if you could perhaps touch on how NOAA's impact or possible potential reductions is going to impact things like the ability for air traffic control and other transportation systems to be able to accurately predict weather patterns.
I'll start. NOAA has a broad purview. It's not just the National Weather Service. So it's monitoring the climate and monitoring how that's changing. And in prior administrations, the Department of Defense was very, very interested in understanding better, as best as we can, what's happening with the climate in different regions of the globe, because there'll be water and arable land issues that are going to arise because of changes, subtle changes and sometimes dramatic changes in regional climate. And that's going to heighten tensions between different groups and different countries in various parts of the world. The Department of Defense wants to have its pulse on all of that so that it knows what the players are up to and what the stresses they're feeling are at any time. It helps to make what's unpredictable already, human behavior, a little bit less unpredictable if you know what the stresses are. Now, if you start to curtail that monitoring situation done by NOAA, you're going to know less about those stresses. Therefore, you're going to know less about possible adversarial stresses between nations. You may know less about your own adversaries. And how is that promoting the national defense? It's doing exactly the opposite. So this is a really good question you're asking. And, I think the erosion of belief and expertise in our country, and it's been hyper-drived in the last couple of months, is a really dangerous thing. And it has lots and lots of interconnected pieces that none of them spell anything positive. So that's what I think about it.
And I agree with John 100%. And the only thing I'll add to that is it's not just the climate that they're interested in, but they also go to the National Weather Service for weather. So when the Department of Defense has ships in the ocean, they want to know where those storms are. They want to know what tsunamis are doing. And those are all things that NOAA picks up. They don't just do the weather forecasting of the atmosphere. They do the ocean forecasting as well.
Yeah, and the Navy has its own numerical weather prediction. The Fleet Numerical is a really good model. But they don't rely just on that when they've got servicemen at sea at risk. Right. They're going to look at as much possible data as they can to make the best decision about navigation. And so that's a really good point, Steve.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Chris. So I believe there are 5 National Weather Service offices that cover Wisconsin. How is that going to affect these cuts at NOAA? Is that going to affect those at all?
Well, there's by some estimates, 1,000 people have lost their jobs, right? That's 20 per state. So if you've got 5 offices in the state, that's presumably something on the order of 2 to 4 people per office. They're already understaffed. And I think that what happens is they have to well, one of the reasons why the balloons are going up once a day at Green Bay, it's not a mandate from DOGE or whatever that thing is. It's a mandate from the people at the Green Bay office saying, here's our budget, here's our time budget. We don't have time to do this twice a day because we've got other things to do because we're short-staffed. So it's a trickle-down negative effect. And when the weather gets extreme, which, as Steve pointed out earlier, we're on the threshold of that season for our state, and the weather is important for agriculture, beginning right now especially, you know, it's just going to be a degradation of services. And I can't imagine how it will not lead to injury at a minimum and loss of life quite likely because of a lack of vigilance that we used to be able to maintain. It's just not possible to do with a shorter staff.
And you talked about farmers, too. I mean, they're pretty, they need to know what the weather's going to be. So there might be less services there for them also.
I think so.
So, John, you know, just to try to get a little lighter here, last week the Old Farmer's Almanac published their summer forecast. And as those of you who listen know.
John loves the John Almanac. Just,
I will tell you that not once in my entire life have I ever looked at this Farmer's Almanac summer forecast. Now, I'll tell you why. It's partly because of my own bias. I love the winter, as Steve says, and Jill knows that, too. I love snowstorms. So I used to look as a kid at what's going to happen this winter, you know. I never looked at the summer forecast, perhaps knowing that it's such nonsense that it wasn't worth the investment in looking at it. As I've said again, people who've listened probably know, I love the Farmer's Almanac as a volume. There's lots of great stuff in it.
Right.
Just rip the weather forecast pages out. You know, just do yourself a favor and don't get your hopes up. I'm speaking from experience. I did it year after year as a kid. It's a waste of time and emotion.
Don't plan your wedding or any other event
around
the Farmer's Almanac.
If you plan your wedding around the Farmer's Almanac, you are forestalling an inevitable divorce. Let me just put it that way.
Okay.
You're trusting the wrong thing.
Couples therapy right here at the Weather Guy.
It's for free.
It's for free. So, you know, the Almanac does do these forecasts, like, you know, for the whole 80 days out or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, how accurate can anybody be with forecasts like that?
I mean, I would say, like, going to NOAA and the ECMWF, where they have the models and the understanding, but as I still don't think that the Farmer's Almanac has said how they do their forecast.
No.
And so if you
magic.
Don't know how they do it, it right, you kind of have to go by what you remember, and that's usually not a good thing to validate.
I think they're
something.
Proud of the fact that it's a secret formula
it's
of
a
some
secret
kind. Yeah. So give me a break. Yeah, but the answer is I think you can't do that. And people
right.
are honestly, I mean, in earnest, trying to make what we call sub-seasonal to seasonal forecasts now. And that science has really gained a lot of ground. Some of it's statistical, and there's some... new influences. We have a new faculty member on our faculty who's an expert in the stratosphere and dynamics of the stratosphere, and that has a long-term influence on the troposphere. So under certain conditions, under certain regimes of stratospheric behavior, you might be able to push the envelope to 20-ish days of a reasonable forecast, but in other times you get it compromised to less than 10. And so 80 is just out of league right now and probably will be certainly for the rest of my life. I would guess probably for the lifetime of the generation or two behind me as well.
Okay.
And not to harp on this too much, but if you don't have the base observations of where you're starting that forecast, you're not going to get better.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Very true. We're talking with the Weather Guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Give us a call. Open lines, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Tomorrow at this time, we'll get a preview of the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo. And then we'll talk to the winemakers at Wollersheim Winery. There's been a change, and we'll tell you about it. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're talking weather. And we have a email from Helen. She recently saw Wisconsin on a list of states that were least affected by climate change. Any reason to think that will change?
That's interesting. I would have framed it this way, and I don't think this is what probably Helen read, but this is maybe a climate island. Our winter is notoriously horrible, and it seems to be ameliorating a little bit. Our summers are never terrible, and if you get a few more days that are unusually humid, it won't be the end of the world. So I don't know. Maybe that's part of the reason why this is becoming sort of a a way to think about the Western Great Lakes states? I don't know, though.
Yeah, I mean, I would think in climate, we're certainly going to be getting warmer with time. We're seeing that already. And that might impart long-term influences of what our winters look like. Mm. But did you just say winters are horrible?
Well, I can have a quote. It's not me. That. I mean, not by. I'm trying to be the everyday person here. Okay. You know, I'm not reflecting my own bias. The winters are, to reflect my bias, they're getting worse, right. But they're certainly not.
Well, I did see
getting worse because they're getting less
yeah,
horrible.
Milder, yeah.
I did see in a list of places where people can go to maybe find areas of the country that were not as affected, you know, by fires and earthquakes drought and whatever. This would be a good place for them to go.
I think that feeds into it.
Yeah, and I think, earlier call I asked about Tornado Alley, you know, so that would be an area where it's getting worse
because of
climate.
Right.
Yeah. Mary in Nina, actually she's visiting Nina, has something for us. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, hi there. I'm visiting from Kona, Hawaii.
I love Kona.
Oh, thanks. I do too. But I did raise my kids around Nina and listen to this program all the time. And when this rainbow occurrence happened, I really wanted to call in. So I'm glad that I happened to be driving and listening. I frequently see rainbows. Our home is looked out over the ocean, and at one point I was watching a rainbow. It formed, and this is the first time I'd ever seen a rainbow where, as I looked up again to check it out, it had literally gotten flat along the ocean. So I could still see it, but it was flat, and it was on the water. How does that happen?
So was the sun on the horizon or just below the horizon?
No, it was probably around 11 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
So
then
midday.
And so associated with rainbows, and we see a lot of those in Hawaii, the rainbow state, as you point out. But in addition to that, you can get other things that look like rainbows, and they're associated with how light interacts not just with water droplets, but ice crystals. And so if you've probably seen halos, around the sun, and sometimes you see sun dogs off to the side. There are also tangential arcs. So I'm betting you were probably seeing something like that, a tangential arc, which is usually pretty thin and above and below where the sun is.
You going to agree with that, John?
Yeah, I've seen a whole bunch of pictures of them. Steve's a real expert on this. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of the pictures of some of this stuff, and there's a tremendous variety of these optical phenomena, but I think the tangential arc is right. I think that's right on target.
Steve, what is it about the Hawaiian Islands that causes so many rainbows?
To get a rainbow, what you want is some precipitation, and they get precipitation. A lot of times it's fallen from small cumulus clouds. You want, and because of that, you now have a lot of open sky for the sunlight to go through. And you want to have a lot of sunlight, and they're much further south than we are, so they have more sunlight. And if it can hit to the bottom of the clouds where the raindrops are falling, then you get to see those right conditions to see it.
Oh, great. Well,
big raindrops, too. Don't they have supernumerary rainbows?
And you want
a little
big,
more?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, they have these big warm cloud raindrops.
You know what they do with bad rainbows?
No.
I know. They send them to prison.
They send them to prison.
It's usually very nice.
It's usually a light sentence. So they have time to reflect.
Man, that's worse than spam right there.
That is lovely. You can keep them coming, Steve. I appreciate it.
The only one I have.
Oh, Mary, thank you so much for calling in, and welcome back to Wisconsin for a little bit. Let's go to Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Go ahead, Dean.
Hi, folks. Great having you on again. Every end of the month, it's so great to talk about weather and related phenomenon. I had a question, and this is sort of like feeds back to what you were early talking about on the issue of NOAA services. We're going up to Lake Superior for the summer to go sailing, and so we really depend upon a good forecast, especially out on the open water. Some little nuances are appearing, and I was wondering if you guys had heard about photoevaporation, and that was, I think, a research study from MIT a year or two ago that indicated there was another mechanism for evaporation, which is particularly important for clouds. And I was wondering if some of that, what your knowledge is of that particular phenomenon.
I've not heard of that.
No, I haven't either. I mean, evaporation, particularly when you think about it over the Lakes of Louise, the way that I think about it is there's a pressure difference between the water vapor just over the water and the water vapor concentration over the water, the vapor pressure difference between over the water and in the atmosphere above. Part of that's driven by solar heating. And so when you said that photo evaporation, that's the thing that came to my mind, but I'm not sure. It's not a phrase I've heard before.
Me either, yeah. I'm unfamiliar with that. Yeah.
All right, well, maybe you can look it up for next time.
Yeah.
You can do it, Steve. You're not doing anything.
I'm not down retired
now. Don't let him fool you. He's busy.
I'll bet he is. Thank you, Dean. Appreciate that. John in Green Bay, you go right ahead.
Okay. Hello. Yes, I've got two questions. The first is when they say that there's 10 miles visibility. Is there somebody that pokes their head out the window and looks at a target 10 miles away?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
They also have light detectors, too. But a lot of times it's, right, you have markers of buildings or trees or something, and based on how that is, that's how you do the visual.
My brother was an Air Force weather observer, and he was down at McCord outside Tacoma, and they had Mount Rainier, and that was perfect, he said. I mean, it took no time to get a sense of the lay of the land for visibility. If you can see certain structures on the mountain or in its vicinity, it was 8, it was 6, it was 10 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how they do it.
From that specific spot, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Who decides on what spots that are used for that?
I think, again, it's related to the issue we were saying before with snowfall, is that if you have other multiple spots around, then you'll look at them in general.
I think that's right.
And a lot of times the visibility is reported in a category.
That's right. That's also true.
Not just 10.1 miles or something. And did he have a second question?
Nope.
Yeah.
Go
when
ahead.
When they say there's tomorrow will be a 50% chance of rain, I thought that always meant that there was a 50-50 chance that it's going to rain tomorrow. But somebody told me that, no, that's not the case. It means that 50% of the area will have rain tomorrow. Is that the case?
I think that is the case, that 50% of the forecast area, and each Weather Service office has several zones that they forecast for, and so I think that is the case. And they're not so large that it almost isn't an equivalent statement, but it's not quite an equivalent statement. Mm-hmm. If you live in one that borders the lake, like if you're in Milwaukee County or something, 50% chance of rain in Milwaukee County this afternoon probably means if you're near the lake, you got a better chance than if you're far on the western side of the county, because the lake breeze will almost surely bring you a drop of rain with its cumulus clouds. But, so there is some distinction to be made there.
Okay, great. Thanks for grabbing that extra question, Steve. I appreciate that. Claire in Sauk County, go right ahead.
Hi, Jill. Thank you. This is a weird question, I know, but Devil's Lake, of course, was formed glacially. Is it possible there's still glacial water in Devil's Lake, or has it all evaporated? There's no natural outlet to the lake, I should add.
That's a good question.
That's a really good question.
That's a really good question. It's also a skinny, pretty small lake. You can look at the whole thing at once. And so, you know, the first thing that came to my mind is, how do you overturn the lake? And you could do it with strong winds so that you get some of the lake water at the bottom. How deep is Devil's Lake? Is it hundreds of feet deep?
It's pretty deep.
Yeah.
So you got to get that water that's hundreds of feet deep to the surface to be able to evaporate.
And that might not be
an easy job to do with the small profile that it presents to the surface. Yeah, I don't know. That's a really good question.
I'm sure our limnologist friends will now email us.
In fact, I suppose they could test it by some sort of isotope analysis. Go down all the way to the bottom, take water down there. Has it got a different chemical constitution than the water at the top?
Yeah.
You could figure that out. That is really a cool question.
Yeah, that is.
That sounds like a nice idea for a thesis.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. It'd be a fun thing to do. It's a beautiful area up there.
Yeah.
And as she was pointing out, it's an amazing place in that there's no outlet.
Yeah, right.
It's like rain either comes in or it evaporates.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. How do you like that?
Well, thank you, Claire. We really appreciate that. You got the guys guessing. Now let's go to Carol. She's between Rhinelander and Minocqua. Go ahead,
Hello?
Carol. Yep, go right ahead.
Hey, Steve Ackerman, you know me. This is Carol Rosenberg from a variety of classes.
Yes, yeah. Right, yeah. From working with you, with, you're a teacher, right? Or were?
I'm a retired teacher, yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah. And it was really cool to hear you responding to that other caller about the things that she saw in the sky. Mm-hmm. And I had a wonderful experience with a 22-degree halo that I saw when I was driving between Rhinelander and Marshfield. And one of the things I do in my retirement is I am historian for Wisconsin Society of Science Teachers. And I immediately was inspired to write my newsletter article about that. And I was there's a great book by Bob Greenler, who you may also know. He was a physics professor at UW-Milwaukee, wrote a book called Halos, Rainbows, and Glories. It tells the story of all of those kinds of things, which are so fun to see.
Yeah, and I have that same book, and it's really explained really nicely. And so I'm thinking back to our caller from Hawaii. She might want to look and take a look at that book and see if he, because he has some good photos in there as well. And she might be able to identify what she was seeing in relation to some of the optical phenomena he talks about.
Okay, well, thank you, Carol. We really appreciate that. So I have heard from sources that Devil's Lake is 46 to 47 feet deep, depending on who you ask.
Okay, that's probably not then going to be deep enough to keep some of that water from, you know, thousands of years ago, I would guess. It probably gets overturned.
Overturn that at some point.
But the frequency of overturn is an interesting question. I don't know how they make an estimate of that based on dimensions of the lake.
Yeah.
Somebody probably knows how.
Probably. In case anybody wants to know, according to the internet, Wisconsin's deepest natural inland lake is, you want to guess?
Lake Winnebago.
Nope, Green Lake.
Really? Wow.
Green Lake.
Mm-hmm. Never would have guessed that.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
How deep is it?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Oh, come on. More than 47 feet.
More than 47,
237
Whoa,
feet.
Whoa, that's stunning. That is
I would have got that multiple choice for all.
Me too. Wow.
Wow, and apparently Wazi Lake, which is man-made, is 355 feet deep.
Whoa.
Ooh,
Wazi Lake.
That's very deep.
Jeff, what's he doing? He's digging a hole. Apparently, that's pretty good.
Well, we would have come across some dinosaurs if there had been some, I'm sure. So, I've also been told, that the Almanac says that the Earth's weather is heavily influenced by sunspots. What do you think about that?
That theory had a lot of credence to it some time ago. I think it's been proven to not really have much influence.
I think the reason why it had some credence back many years ago, one is the number of sunspots does indicate how much solar radiation, particularly higher energy solar radiation, comes from the sun. Whether it intercepts the planet is another thing. Mm. But they run in a 22-year cycle. Mm. And I think there was some studies, in the early 40s or 50s that were looking at trying to figure out what kind of cycles does the weather have. And so they were trying to correlate that 22-year cycle to some cycles that we were seeing in weather.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever been rigorously proven.
Kind of a little bit of a crackpot idea, seems like,
Yeah, something you would see in Farmer's Almanac about weather.
Exactly right. It fits perfectly in the headlines of the almanac. Yeah.
Just so you know, this is Stephen John's opinion. This is not the opinion of WPR.
And as John says, he reads it. He just doesn't read the
weather.
The
weather part.
Just stay away
from
that. Right.
Stay away.
Yep.
He plants by the moon, but he's not going.
They got great historical stuff. Calendar and what happened on this day. It's just fascinating. But don't look at it for the weather.
So speaking of the sunspots, now Northern Lights. We had a pretty nice season of Northern Lights.
Once.
Are they coming back? Do you know? Is that...
I don't know if there's predictions. I mean, I monitor NOAA, puts out a forecast about whether or not there are high energy activity coming from the sun heading towards our way. And whether or not it's going to be a minor, major, or just a regular event. And I look at that every week
when
it comes out. And looks for the major event. Anything other than that, then I figured we're not going to see.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for being with us again today. We always look forward to it. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor of Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Services. John Martin is a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Thank you so much for listening today. Thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. And of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau, executive producer. Thanks for listening.